You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Ben Jaffe, the unemployed.
God, you must start the show like that.
I can't wait. You know, I have to say, you look relaxed and peaceful and at ease, and I'm wondering why. Is it because you're unemployed?
Well, first of all, there's a difference between being unemployed unintentionally and unemployed intentionally. I am currently between jobs. I already have where I'm landing secured. So I feel bad calling myself unemployed because there are a number of people who are unintentionally unemployed.
But I have to say, at some point when you work for the Big Blue, then we'll know that you're not unemployed.
Isn't
it'll
there,
be fun.
There is a Big Blue something. Isn't that a
IBM,
robot?
IBM is actually a Big Blue. But the new Big Blue is Facebook.
That's Yeah.
But right. IBM is traditionally is Big Blue, I think.
That's true.
So why are you so relaxed?
Yeah, believe it or not, in the last week I've been to Hawaii and back.
Since last I spoke with you?
Since last you spoke with me, week ago.
You jumped on an airplane, shot over to Hawaii, and hung out for how long?
Hung out for 5 days.
And how is this geeky news? Besides braggatory, sir.
I notice geeky things everywhere I go. I was on the airplane thinking, how crazy is it that, so first of all, the Pacific Ocean is huge, right? Mm-hmm. It takes a long time to fly over that thing, and
even,
I only flew halfway.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Beyond that, I was going really, really fast. I was going 500 miles an hour on a Boeing 7-something-7. And it's crazy to me to think of the numbers there. Like, it's so huge and I'm going so fast and yet it still takes so long. So it was a five hour and 50 minute flight, I think it was. And I brought along with me some noise canceling headphones.
Good call. Does it work on an airplane?
Well, on the way there, it did not work because the batteries were dead. But I did stop by the CVS in Hawaii, and there's a CVS in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Sure. There's everything in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
It's just
cattle and the whole deal.
It's weird to me. Like,
so noise-canceling headphones have microphones on them, and then they take the sound that comes around from the environment and amplify that sound in an inverse phase into your ear. That cancels the sound out.
That was a lot of words there.
And effect. Yeah, you want to do it in 10,000?
Imagine that if you have a very, very simple sound, let's say the sound is going womp, 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 but it's actually going a lot faster than that. What the headphones can do is they can look at the phase of that sound and they can produce a sound that's exactly the opposite phase. And so all of the positive, the pressure air versus the less pressurized air, the headphones can actually detect that and then produce that canceled sound wave and create that inverse sound wave in the headphones and effectively cancel it out.
Yeah, the long and the short of it is when you put these on, the room buzz, the other sounds you hear just go away.
Have you used them?
I've put other people's on. I've never had them.
You don't have them?
I have them on my wish list.
I have. I see. Send me a URL, and I will probably.
Do you
not
like
buy
these
you.
Ones? What are they?
They're Bose noise canceling headphones. Right.
Any of these work pretty well, right?
They're amazing, and probably cheap ones work quite well too. These are fairly high end in terms of how much you can spend on them. I got them because I spend a ton of time programming in a noisy environment. Right? I guess not this month, but last month and next month. Both Udacity and Facebook have open floor plans. And so that means there are a lot of people all buzzing around, all trying to talk to you. You can put your headphones on, which makes people not bother you, but you still hear a lot of noise. But the weird thing is that it works. Like, it feels like it shouldn't work. It feels like
magic.
For the first time in my life, there's actually a mute button
for the world
in my skull is what it feels like.
Do you know that you can do these just with tubes and analog? You can actually set up tubes from your ears, and then you... I can't remember the shape of it.
Set up tubes from your ears?
You can stick tubes in your ears, and then, you match them together and invert their... I can't remember how it works, but it's a physical manifestation of this that will do the same thing. Yes.
Yeah, it probably doesn't work as well.
Probably not.
Also, I should point out that this especially works for low-frequency sound, mm-hmm. not as much for high-frequency sound.
Why?
So it's because high-frequency sound vibrates a lot faster, and so the headphones have to react
quicker.
Quicker, yeah. And it's a lot harder
to do.
But the
drone of an aircraft is perfect. All right, Ben's noise-canceling Pacific Ocean flight experience.
If you ever get a pair of noise-canceling headphones, last geeky thing... not so much a fact, but just kind of a weird fun thing you could do to just completely confuse your brain. Go into a not very noisy room, like, this room right now, mm-hmm. and put one of your earphones on your ear and the other one take it off.
You're doing this right now.
And then turn on your noise-canceling headphones.
Do you feel like you're going to fall over?
All of a sudden, my left ear went blank. And my right ear, I'm just hearing what I've been hearing my entire life, which is the ambient room noise.
At Cabrillo College, where I went to got my associate's degree, uh-huh. The theater there, on the stage right and stage left entrance from the stage, when you walked up the stairs, there was noise baffling material on the side of the proscenium.
Yeah.
And as you walked by it, there was no sound from that side. And it was common, like probably three times going up and down, I would fall into it. Oh. I would fall over as I walked past
because
it.
Because it just messes with your vestibular system. Yeah,
just enough to brush up against it.
You know? Another thing that are crazy, I can only take people's word on this, but I've heard from numerous people, anechoic chambers are crazy. Anechoic chambers are basically rooms that are built to absorb as much sound into the walls as possible.
And we have an automatic gain control in our ear. And so
automatic gain control, meaning that you like start listening for the quieter and quieter and quieter sounds because you don't hear anything. And so you start hearing your heartbeat in it.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if this is apocryphal or not.
No, I hear it's true.
But Meyer Sound up in Berkeley, they have an anechoic chamber. It just looks like this trailer kind of, but if you go inside, they've got tons of foam and everything. And someone told me that they have a standing bet that if you can survive in there without going a little mad for an hour, then they'll buy you a six-pack of beer. And I don't know if this is true. If anyone knows whether this is true or not, please do write into the show because I've been wondering this for years.
All right. Follow-up from last week.
Yes.
Frank from Facebook wrote in to say, guys...
From Facebook.
Well, no.
Writing
using
on Facebook.
Using the Facebook. He looked up Geeks... KOSP Geeks on Facebook, which is our tag on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And said, by the way, I listened to last week's show, Jerry Rig, which we referred to at one point. You called it Jury Rig, and I then said, it's actually Jerry Rig. And I looked it up, and then you said, what does it stand for? And I said, well, I'm not going to get into that.
Like,
well, he did get into
Jerry?
It. Yeah, unfortunately, it's a derogatory term for German fighters in World War II era. Now, it's a testament to our time frame where I knew the term Jerry was a representation of a German fighter in derogatory term, but I did not connect that. And normally I'm pretty good about connecting old derogatory terms to the, you know, what their meaning was and to stop using that. For example, I used to, as a child, use the word gyp to represent something taken away from you.
Like
it actually
gypped.
Comes from gypsies. That's an abbreviation. So that's a derogatory term. So there are phrases.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I didn't know that Jerry was from that. Entirely. And I got a little bummed because I do like the term Jerry Rig. And so then I was talking with Maggie and I was like, well, maybe we could use Mickey Mouse. She's like, you want to be derogatory to Mickey Mouse? Because that's if you Mickey Mouse something, it means you're kind of sticking it together with bubblegum tape. You know about that?
I'm learning so much right now.
Feel free to do that. But Keith Musket, a friend of the show and been on the show, I believe, actually said he agrees that Jerry Rig does come from World War II, but Jury Rig is a term used in sailing for making an improvised sail when the sail is ripped or the boat dismantled. So you can use Jury Rig because it's not derogatory. It has to do with sailing.
So
you good with that?
It might be that Jury Rig is a non-derogatory term.
Yes.
And Jerry Rig is a corruption of that term.
Probably it could be
because
it could be that be the case. Yeah,
we had sails before we had World War II.
So unbeknownst to you, you were yes, we did.
We did.
Unbeknownst to you, actually, the demise of sailing happened in World War II. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
so unbeknownst to you, you're using a term that was less common, I think. I hear jerry rig more often, but much more appropriate. So everyone switch to jury rig or
jury,
to Mickey
in
Mouse
like
something.
Jury duty, jury,
yes,
jury rig.
Yes, exactly.
Not jerry like
or,
Tom and Jerry.
Or stop using the term completely and think of something else. I don't know, like Mickey Mousing something. Or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
Second correction. Last week.
A second correction.
Partially. Because last week you were just talking about the water systems that you were putting in at
home.
Oh,
yeah. We were talking about plumbing.
Yeah. And you were using.
And I was talking about how completely incompetent I am.
Let's go deeper into that incompetence, shall we?
Okay.
PVC, polyvinyl chloride piping, should not be used for hot water. I looked this up after the show.
Oh.
And so don't use that for hot water. It's probably not so bad if you're just putting it over your body. But if you were to put it into vessels and then put it into your body, it's probably not so good.
Oh, because of chemical leaching.
Yeah, well, basically polyvinyl chloride actually does melt under temperature. You can make really cool bows out of this stuff. Just be careful, because when you do burn it, you make chlorine gas. Not a good idea.
Oh.
But in any case, Keith also recommended go ahead and start using PEX if you want to use this cheap, easy watering system. So PEX.
PEX.
Do you know what PEX is? PEX?
PEX. No, no, wait, hold on. PVC melts around 160 degrees. So it's probably still not a bad idea, or it's probably not a good idea, but it won't melt putting water through it.
Well, your piping hasn't melted as you showered, right? It's totally
right.
Still there.
Right.
But it does get soft, and because of that, you definitely don't want to use hot water through it.
It says it starts to decompose when the temperature is 140 degrees centigrade.
Well, don't do that. It would burn your skin.
Right.
Very, very badly.
That'd be steam.
I think it has to do with that they don't, PVC specs say don't use hot water.
Sure.
I don't think
okay.
It's actually about the material, what happens to it. But as we know with plastics, you really want to follow the specs on these things.
Yeah, I'm not making an argument to like ignore safety recommendations.
But the reason I didn't mention PEX last week is I couldn't remember the name of it, PEX. It's a type of, it's been a plumbing replacement. It's replaced copper. You can use it for doing also for propane and natural gas.
Is it plastic?
It's plastic. PEX stands for cross-linked polyethylene. I think that's the way it is.
Polyethylene X.
Yeah.
Cross-linked.
That's the abbreviation. It's also sometimes called XLPE for cross-linked polyethylene. The X stands for the cross. I'm not sure the linking. I think it's the strength regarding it. But anyway, there's a whole Wikipedia page on it. We'll put it up. But the thing that's great about this is that it's a flexible, strong material. You get it color-coded based off of hot and cold. So it comes in red and blue.
Oh, cool.
Which is nice. And then it also comes in another color for using it for natural gas, which means you don't have to do natural glass work. Gas work is really hard. So
yeah.
I recommend PEX if you're going to be doing some plumbing stuff. You can learn about it. Yeah, there you go.
So do you want to come
flexible.
Over to... Do you
it's flexible, so it's exactly what you want for your hot...
Do you want to come over to my house?
I love coming over to your
house.
Me? If you're not away in Hawaii.
We just need to find some time to hang out outside of the show. And we'll be good.
Yeah, that's true. We could just stop doing the show for a week and then we can hang out.
Yeah, see you guys. House. We're going to go away.
All right, so what have you been working on?
Oh,
I mean, I know you're going to Hawaii and relaxing stuff, but you're a programmer, so you can't stay away from the code, right?
Your
time off?
I tried. I've been really trying. I mean, one of those projects was doing that plumbing, right?
Yeah. Wrong.
was failing at doing the plumbing. So my partner, Masumi, she is a music teacher. And so she was thinking, gosh, there are a lot of specific things that are redundant and repetitive. And it's a little joke there. And that are just a pain in the butt to do over and over again. Sounds like the job of a computer program, right?
What's the example that she's mentioning?
Well, so what she spends a lot of her time doing is she teaches young kids how to sing. And so in teaching that, she has to choose different songs based on certain things that they have to learn, learning objectives, we'll say. But then she also has to kind of keep in mind how many of these games are standing games versus sitting games versus dancing games. You know, how many of these are the like negative wisdom that we want them to come away with versus other stuff that prepare them for that moment, right?
Okay.
And so you can imagine there are a lot of songs that that she has to teach. And actually, the amazing thing to me is that most of these songs are like la 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 la. They're two notes, three notes.
Uh-huh.
There are so many songs with two notes or three notes. It's incredible. And all of us know them. We just don't know we know them until we hear them.
I didn't know I knew that until you sang that.
Yeah. So she's been building an app for it. And it's fantastic. It's using React and Firebase. Yeah, it's for her.
Okay.
So it's a web app.
React is a web framework. What's Firebase?
Firebase is a
database service. Gosh,
how do you? Yeah, it's a database service, which just makes it really easy to create a data store without having to manage how do you push things to a database? How do you, manage all of your tables and all that stuff?
Cool.
So it's a little easier to use, especially if you're creating just a basic front-end web app. So she's put this app together with some help from me. And I found that it's intriguing to me because it's so much easier to create than to create really well with an eye for maintainability, right?
Oh, yeah.
So this is the journey that probably anyone in any kind of technical profession goes through is I can solder things. Mm-hmm. I can't solder them very well, right? I can program. I can't necessarily program very well when I first start. And so I found actually that a lot of the time that I've been spending on her app helping her or working independently on her app has been cleaning up loose ends and setting her up to succeed.
In later stages.
Because if she does succeed in later stages, then she's going to have a positive experience.
I totally follow what you're talking about, but we're getting a little abstract for everyone. So right. Let's kind of put this into an example that makes sense in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a difficult thing to talk about because we're talking about complexity and maintainability.
And abstraction.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's say this. Let's just say we're making a car and we have a welder as a tool. Right?
Okay.
So every time you want to attach two pieces of metal, you just weld it. Because why not? It's easy. It's fast. By the way, welder, fast, easy, really fun.
Not with PVC.
Not good for PVC. Or PEX for that matter. Or any plastics, really. Actually, you can weld plastics. We won't get into that.
Let's just
so you're welding along. So you get your starter and you get it all set up and it all works perfectly and you hot weld it to the
block. So all your tools are ready and you're... Yeah.
So now you've got your starter and you've connected up your belt and you've got it adjusted kind of right and then you weld the starter up. Boom, it's welded to the car. And then you get your next part, you weld it.
And then eventually you get to the side panels of the car and you weld them on.
You weld those on. And then the car is awesome.
It's like a tank.
And it's strong and there's nothing falling off and you don't have to buy extra screws. It's great.
2 years later, your starter breaks.
I would say, you have a real problem once you need any kind of maintenance.
Because you can't unweld that thing.
Not easily,
really.
Without grinding it. And then you have this whole problem of you're losing material and you're damaging the integrity of the vehicle as you take the panels off. All these problems emerge, not because the car didn't work off the gate, but because you didn't think about the maintainability of the car.
Right. And so
you're talking about that in software development.
Right, exactly. And so if you take all the pieces of your app and you componentize them, you create these individual components that can talk to each other well or attach to each other well, but are not the same component, right?
Like the engine and the starter.
Right. And so later on, if, let's say, Firebase doesn't work very well, we could just take that entire data store, the place where all the data comes from, and say, you know what, we're going to use this other data store. And if we've done our job right, we can effectively just unscrew it, take it off, put in another one, and screw it back in.
Is this an ORM of some kind? Automated model?
What is... Firebase?
Yeah.
Have you used Firebase?
I don't know. That's why I asked
what it was. It's just JSON.
Okay. All
right. So it's basically you've got a big object full of stuff and you just interact with it as if it's here on your computer.
And really it's on a net remote server.
Really it's actually far away.
Very comparable to the company I used to work for, Wakanda.
Yeah.
Did the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Very cool. So it's just interesting because at first I thought I would be helping her a lot with the development of features.
Right. She knows what she wants, and she's adding those features.
Yeah, and she knows how to make it happen.
Right.
She doesn't necessarily know how to make it happen looking to the future because she hasn't done any maintenance on an application, or she hasn't thought I need to structure my database this way so that way I can implement this feature later.
The experience that you have as a developer. And
right.
The thing that's interesting is that one of the reasons we have side effects of standards in our society where starters are removed and there's bolt holes and all that. Those ideas come from long-term practice of this is a best way to do this. This is the best way to build a building. You want to put the window in this way and you want to seal it and that way water won't get into it. All these standards exist in the physical world. But in software development, it is very hard to create standards for software development because the software development platforms change so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in the situation where you have best practices, which are kind of like adopted standards, which you can deviate from all the time.
Uh-huh.
But those help. And of course, there's practice methodologies of software design style where you actually... create a way of your flow of development produces the effect of being able to quickly maintain all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of called rapid development or development driven or agile development. But we won't get more into that.
It's a whole rabbit hole.
It is. And that's so cool that
and
she's developing
software.
And
you and I live in it, but...
Very true.
Yeah.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Ben Jaffe. He's about to tell me about what three words. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. And Ben, what is what three words? This is Ben Jaffe, by the way, with me.
Yo. What three words? Okay. So, what comes to mind when I say steer bliss bands?
Nope.
Nothing?
No. Is it a song?
But if I were to tell you this over the phone, I could easily describe these three words to you, right?
A steer is a male cow, or a way to try to a
drive
verb.
A thing. Yeah. Yeah.
A bliss is means like a state happiness. Of mind, like what you feel like in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Bands, like I'm in three bands.
Yeah.
Or something, right?
Yeah.
So this is actually a location. This is actually, these three words actually represent the specific 3x3 meter area that I parked my car in today, just outside of the building.
No.
Yes.
Okay, so.
Isn't that a beautiful idea?
So normally, longitude, latitude coordinates on the planet are these long things. And if you want to say, this is my location, you pass around a longitude, latitude, which are hours and minutes and seconds of degrees.
It's like 127.
You're never going to remember that.
Six, yeah, it's like three numbers, comma. Oh, three numbers and then either in north or south. And then three numbers and it's just like not memorable at all.
No, no.
Also, if you've tried reading numbers to somebody over the phone.
Not so useful.
It doesn't work so well.
But steer bliss bands, on the other hand, I could probably memorize that.
Yeah.
So what three words, how does this do this?
Right. So this is actually, this is a new service. The whole idea behind this, first of all, let's now talk about what the problem this is that's trying to solve. If you want to get to a location, if I want to send you to a location, if I want you to come over to my house or whatever, you say, okay, what's your address?
Yes.
And I say, oh, my address is blah, 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 redacted, don't come to my house. just very
France.
Conscious that plenty of people are listening right now. And you would go to my address by typing it into Google Maps. Google Maps would resolve that to some kind of a longitude and latitude, and then you'd be off on your way.
Right. And actually, it would give me, it would translate to a longitude and latitude that I wouldn't even know. And then it would give me driving directions to that location.
Yep.
So like after I've gotten your address, I then have the LAN. Then I can have my map, my direction software do what it needs to do. I don't even need to know your address really.
Now, where is my address though? Is my address off of the street? Is my address halfway into the block? Is my address,
I would say it was on the street within a few meters.
See, I don't know. I mean, Google Maps disagrees. It puts the little dot on my house. But of course, it doesn't really know where my house is. I could clear my house and I could build another house behind it.
I think that Google knows where your house is.
Well, they probably do.
So what does this three-word thing help with?
4 billion people on this planet don't have a physical address.
Right.
So how do you send a shipment to them? How do you go over to wherever they are?
You find some shared location near them that they've agreed upon and you ship it to there.
Right. And then what if the person who manages that shared location, maybe it's a some kind of business, steals the package or loses the package or isn't there
when... Yeah, you could have a problem.
It's just, it can be pretty difficult.
Or also, what if I'm like meeting you? Very commonly, I'll say, hey, let's meet someplace. And like, we kind of know the area, but we don't have address information for the area.
In fact,
it's like... Even here at Netflix, like if I give a Netflix address and you say, you know, meet me here, I got to tell you a building, I got to tell you in the front or the back because it's really complicated.
And you use many more than three words to tell me
that. I do.
So this is a startup called What Three Words. And the idea is that because there are so many words and because if you take all of those words and you multiply all those possible words by themselves again and then a third time, you get so many possible addresses. You get 57 trillion.
That's enough for the planet.
Possible squares on the planet. And if you use this particular, you get at least that much. There's actually air checking involved in this and everything.
Cool.
I'm not exactly sure what metrics they use. But their goal is to have a three-word address for every single one of these 57 trillion squares, all of these
meters.
3x3 meter squares on the planet.
That's a good enough space
that can be communicated quickly, easily, and with no ambiguity.
That's about 10 feet by 10 feet, by the way.
Yeah.
So it's a small space. So you can basically go and in the software, pick a spot, like a drop a pin, then get the three words for that spot and send it to somebody via the phone.
Right.
You can also, I guess outside my office here is steer bliss bands.
What language do you speak?
I speak English.
Right. So they've solved this problem and they can do it in Spanish or French or German or Italian,
Swahili.
Wait,
would it be the translation of the Steer Bliss bands?
I'm a little bit fuzzy on that, but I imagine that the words that they're using are words that have unambiguous translations in all of these different languages.
Awesome.
Right?
So whatever a male steer is in Spanish is the steer.
The amount of information that it requires on your phone or your computer to resolve this, 5 megabytes.
Nice. You can have the whole database on your phone.
Yeah. So they've
I love it.
Smushed
it's,
it into it's this.
It's whatthreewords.com to take longitude, latitude, and put it into a phrase that you can actually use. And it sounds like they're going to be the standard if they're the ones that have done this. Feels like they've been around for a while. I feel like I've heard about this before.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure when they started. But if we get something like Google Maps integration for a service like this, it probably will become the new standard.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Until that happens, I don't know. But I love the idea, and it certainly solves a problem that we have, and we don't have a way of getting around right now.
Hey, Ben, it's been a while since we've done some space news. Would you mind if you give us some space update?
Yeah. So there was actually a recent study, and they released the results, and it turns out that the objects of interest identified by the Kepler space program, which is a satellite looking at stars and trying to figure out if there are planets around it outside of our solar system.
They look at it by the light wobble, if you will.
Not the light wobble. They do a transit. So if a planet passes in front of a star, you see the star's output appear to dip for just a second. If you see that multiple times, then you know that there's something going around and around and around. So there are many things beside that that could cause the same phenomenon. So one is if you have a transiting object moving through the galaxy that just happens to pass in front of a star. It's not orbiting it. It just happens to pass in front of it. An eclipsing binary. So if you have two stars that are orbiting each other, and it turns out there are a ton of these binary star systems. There was one in Star Wars too. Or you could also have a brown dwarf that would be dimmer than the main star, and they could be kind of orbiting each other in concert.
Well, also, even if you had two stars next to each other, the light, I'm assuming at that point, would be more than if they were in line with each other, because one would block the light.
Right, but there is some complexity. Like, if you look at the brown dwarf
example, lensing as well,
there's lensing, which is probably minuscule, but in any case, there's also the brown dwarf example, where you've got this very dim star and this very bright star. And so as they go around each other, you see this light dip. And the signal that the satellite looks at is fairly noisy, and so it's kind of hard to really resolve this with a lot of resolution. So they did kind of a more involved study of a lot of these planetary candidates.
Yeah.
And they found that actually half of them are not planets.
Oh.
Half of them are eclipsing binaries or brown dwarfs when they looked more closely at the data, and they also looked at the star's wobble. And so they were able to figure out which direction it was moving and kind of like based on Doppler shift and everything. It's kind of cool if you go and read about it. But they kind of took those two methods, put them together to figure this out.
To find out that we didn't actually have as many exoplanets as we thought.
Yeah, we've got about half of them.
Wow, that's kind of amazing. Sad or kind of cool.
Here's the thing that excites me about this particular story. Although some people might point to this and say, like, see, science is wrong. The coolest thing about science to me is that not only is it predictive, the things that science gives us tend to be predictive, but also that it is constantly refining itself, right? So we don't make a discovery and then say, okay, we're done. You know, this is the truth. We keep poking at it and prodding at it. And having that knowledge that we will keep poking and prodding means that the information we get from scientific discovery will only get better and better and better, as opposed to just being there as the canonical truth that everyone accepts. I think that's really beautiful. And I love seeing things like this where we say, like, what we thought is wrong, or it's half right in this case, but it's okay. Here's the cool science that came out of it.
So that's fantastic. You're right. The scientific method would be great if we could use the scientific method in even more things in our world.
Yeah, this wonderful segue just fell into our lap, actually.
How so?
Well, the second half of the show, we have an interview with Aileen Lerner.
The CEO of Interviewing.io. That's
right. Absolutely. And that's a startup that kind of aims to take some of this scientific methodology and apply it to interviewing.
Which, of course, is not normally very scientific. But you'll find out more about that. Just stick with us right now as I talked with Aileen Lerner. Aileen Lerner is the founder and CEO of Interviewing.io, her startup company regarding interviewing, obviously, which we'll get to in a second. But first, Aileen, I want to talk to you about a blog article of yours from June 2013, Lessons from a Year's Worth of Hiring Data. You were a technical recruiter, and in the technical field in Silicon Valley, basically there's a front-end group of people, the recruiters, who filter out resumes and such, then pass them off to hiring recruiters that are kind of like this middle range person. What role did you play?
So the company where I was running hiring at the time was not particularly large. We were about 100 people. So as a recruiter, I kind of had to do everything. It was what was called end-to-end recruiting, mm-hmm. which meant that not only was I the person that was doing initial filtering, but I was also seeing people through the process, extending offers, and working on our brand, really doing a little bit of everything. The weird thing about my role in particular was because I was an engineer before taking this job, I was kind of a hybrid. Mm-hmm. So in addition to filtering people the way a normal recruiter would, I was also the person that actually did a lot of our first round technical interviews.
Okay, so the phone interviews, the phone screening kind of interviews?
That's right.
Yeah, I do that myself in my current role at Netflix.
Oh, nice.
And that definitely is not normally the recruiter role. It's normally the hiring manager's role.
Yeah, a lot of the time there's a recruiter call, but that is really more about cultural fit or selling the company, answering questions, and kind of getting the person going and getting them into the pipe. I was doing that, but I was also trying to make sure that they could code at least well enough to go on to the next round.
So over a year, you interviewed phone screened interview, technical interviews, 300 people.
Yeah, it was actually a little more than that for the specific role that the blog post is about. It was around 300, but I think it was around 500 total.
Wow.
So a lot of my daily life was interviewing people nonstop.
It's not surprising that you did your startup around that topic.
Yeah, that's exactly why.
We'll definitely get into your startup. But I want you to ask, the things I found out about your blog that I didn't actually know is what kind of, you basically took a data science analysis of the 300 or 500 people that you had interviewed, their resumes, their grammatical resumes, information on their resume, like what school they went to, things of that nature, and kind of looked at it statistically on whether you made an offer to them or not, and came up with some really interesting conclusions on what makes a good resume, what makes a good person, what makes a good fit, and what to look for. Can you give me some summaries of what you found?
Sure. Well, I don't know that we know what makes a good person, but we looked at a bunch of factors. So everything from the number of typos on people's resumes, which I had a great time counting by hand.
Yeah, that's 300 resumes or so. Yeah. You had to count them. I noticed even in your sample image of a phrase, you'd counted an extra space. That's a hard one to find in a PDF. So.
Yeah. It was, I would do it late at night, sometimes with a beer. Mm-hmm. But I think I counted most things correctly. So that was one of the things we looked at. We also looked at where people had gone to school, whether it was considered a top school, where they had worked before, what the highest degree that they earned was, the frequency of kind of buzzwords in their resume, and
What do you mean buzzwords in their resume?
So if you look at a typical resume, at least the way that people I think are told to write their mm-hmm. resumes, they will spend maybe a little bit of time describing what they actually did at their positions, and then there will be this long list of keywords, right? So,
yes.
You know, and people sometimes really get into it, so they'll mention every operating system they've ever seen. They'll mention that they know how to use Microsoft Word.
You're describing a former resume of mine. I definitely
mine
had
too,
everything.
Right?
Yeah.
Well,
I played with Perl for a long time. I know Perl. I'll put that on there.
Yeah.
Useful.
I once wrote a Perl script that was all one line. Yeah, I totally know Perl. That was what we considered buzzwords. Yeah. And what other features
So basically just kind of tag cloud all the words that were in the document, found the ones that are more likely in most of the documents, and then use that as one of the markers on whether if it affected a person's hire or not. All these things are about whether an offer was extended to them or not.
That's right.
Okay. So buzzwords, spelling typos, where they went to school, the prestige of their school.
Mm-hmm.
Anything
That's
else?
Right.
I think that was good.
Where they had worked. Also, one other thing that we looked at, which ended up mattering, I guess we'll get to that, a little more nebulous, was how clearly they could explain what they had actually done.
Yeah, definitely. What a person did on their resume or per job, you'd think would be very clear. But in reality, what they write sometimes isn't. So I'm going to go ahead and read the one that I think is pretty bad. Design software. This is a description of what they did at a job, you know, some job, some technical thing. Design software application, including data modeling, software architecture design, software hardware integration, user interface design, and database management. Okay, so those are just buzzwords put together. That could almost describe
any job,
anything.
Right? Yeah.
So the alternate of this, go ahead and read that one, would you?
Yeah, so this is the one that we thought was a little bit better. This created and launched a service that collects product opinions and recommendations from Twitter. The service finds related tweets, removes spam, analyzes sentiment, and creates a structured database of everything that was said about particular products.
It's really concise. It clearly talks about what it is. Anybody could read that and kind of go, oh, I know what that does.
Exactly.
You know, especially a technical hiring recruiter could do that. So you found, so this is one of the ones, like, we're able to describe what they did as the metric. So this had to be, you just had to judge based on reading them.
Yeah, it was a little hand wavy, but most of these were, it was a pretty bimodal distribution. Either people sounded like the one that you read, where I had no idea what they did at all, and it could have applied to any job, or it was pretty clear.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so of all these different things, what was the most important metric on whether an offer would be made to somebody, what their resume said about them?
So this was super, super surprising to us, but it ended up being the number of grammatical errors and typos on their resume. By far, that was the strongest indicator that somebody might get an offer. In fact, I believe if people had more than three errors on their resumes, their odds of getting an offer dropped off extremely drastically.
Irregardless of what else that was on the resume.
That's right.
And how much experience they had. So grammar matters.
Grammar and spelling and definitely matter.
And these are just, sometimes they're typos, like an extra space or something can be one of those negatives.
That's right.
Why was that surprising to you? Because, I mean, it does make logical sense, right? The first line of defense normally are this pre-screen where somebody picks up a resume that has no technical experience and looks at it and assesses. And if they look like they can't spell or have problems with grammar, then clearly that's going to be a negative to some level. And then every step in the process, that's going to happen. It's going to give a first impression, if you will.
That's right. I think it was surprising to me because a lot of the best engineers that I know aren't necessarily fantastic writers, especially when they're writing quickly and thinking quickly. But what I realized as I thought more about it was that the resume is really a living document. It's not something you do on the fly. It's something that you have every opportunity to edit. In fact, some of the criticisms the study has gotten is that this biases hiring managers and recruiters against non-native speakers.
Absolutely does.
And that's a legitimate concern.
But there's a simple solution to this, right? I mean, you just get someone that you know that has really great grammar skills.
To proofread it.
And proofread it and modify it for you.
Exactly. Some of this, I think, is an indirect measure of self-awareness.
Yeah.
If you know you're not a very good speller, and a lot of us aren't, then be aware of that and take some steps to mitigate it before you send in this representation of who you are and before you put what's supposed to be your best foot forward.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Elaine Lerner. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm speaking with Elaine Lerner. She was a technical recruiting manager for a long time, hiring manager for a long time, and now runs a startup called Interviewing.io, which we'll get to just, I know, keep on talking about it, but in a minute we'll talk about it. We're talking about what are the actual metrics that matter with regards to a resume and a person in their hiring, and the spelling and grammar is the most important. What's the second one that you found?
Yeah, the second one was where they had worked before. Mm-hmm. This one was the one that was probably least surprising. Yeah. If somebody has already let you through their filters, then you're vetted in some sense. But what was very surprising is that even though having worked at a top company seemed to matter, having gone to what's considered a top computer science school or having had a high GPA or low GPA didn't seem to matter at all.
So your MIT degree doesn't help you?
Well, I think it tricks people into thinking I'm smart before they meet me. That's really what it does best.
So that does make sense. Pedigree of technical position before. So if you've worked at a Yahoo or a Google or a Facebook or something,
Exactly. Then
you can pretty much vet that, oh, well, that person was an engineer at Google, and we know Google has a high bar, and therefore, if they were there for more than a year, they're probably a good engineer.
Probably.
In fact, even if they were just hired, they're probably doing okay. That makes sense. But I'm surprised that the schooling didn't matter as much. Because, of course, that's what we argue to high school students who are going into school. You need to get a good degree. And if you can get into
otherwise,
a prestigious school,
your life is
over, ruined.
Right? Yeah. Completely. Everything's wrong afterwards.
You're saying that's bogus, though.
I think it's completely bogus.
Why? And is that okay, I should say?
I'm actually glad this is the case. I'd hate for the world to be such that one poor decision in your life determines the course of your life for the rest of your existence. That's awful. I think that I can only really speak about my experience. When I went to school, I had no idea what I wanted to do, and it took me a while to figure it out. And I did well in some computer science classes, and in some I did poorly. I think that what people do on their own terms and with their own initiative ends up counting a lot more than what they do, because that's the next step in a series of steps they're supposed to take.
In Silicon Valley, we have a bit of an understanding that some of the most successful people that started companies dropped out of college, right?
That's right.
Jobs is a perfect example of that. But yeah, it's a pretty common thing to see that. But I think that's at a prestige level. I don't think that's like everyday people. So you went through this experience and you saw what was actually important in hiring such. And this motivated to some degree starting your company, interviewing.io. Describe what the company does, what your focus is.
Yeah. So after having done this study, and after actually, I'll tell you very quickly about one other one that I did I think really drove the founding of interviewing.io. So after I did this, I thought, you know what? It's really messed up that what matters more than anything else on a resume is number of typos.
Yeah.
Maybe that means that resumes aren't that great. I don't know. So what I did was I took a bunch of resumes of people that I had placed when I was working as a recruiter and anonymized them and then showed them to a bunch of recruiters and engineers who were involved in interviewing and hiring managers and asked them just one question. Would you interview this person?
Okay, so you're removing their names, so you don't know gender and you don't know racial history, right? And I'm assuming anything else that might have been at that level. Were you removing college?
I left college on, but we obfuscated the dates.
Okay, so you didn't know the age as well. That's good. So all the dates were obfuscated. Of course, if they were at some place for 15 years, you could assume their age was not college student.
Exactly.
But in general, tried to minimize that. And you took all these same people. You had a whole bunch of breadth of data because you knew whether these people are hired or not.
That's right.
Just gave resumes and said, go. What do you think? And what did you find?
So two things. The first one was that nobody could really tell who the good people were. I'll be honest,
what?
I kind of suspected that engineers would do better at this task than recruiters because they have a little more depth and have some domain-specific knowledge. Everybody sucked at this equally, pretty much. In some sense, it was almost like flipping a coin.
Well, the resume is useless in that regard because then you're just backing off to your biases on gender and race or age.
But that information wasn't even there. So
that's what I'm saying is if these resumes are useless when you remove that information and we still believe that resumes are important, then the only thing that's really important is not the stuff that's on the resume. It's this other stuff, which you shouldn't be judging people against anyway.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the day, then you're just looking to see if the person is like you or not.
Or do you think that in general resumes, even when they do have all the information on there of a person is, just isn't a useful methodology at all?
I'm beginning to believe that that's actually true. The other thing, so the filter here was whether I'd been able to place these people, and that's not perfect, right? There are a lot of things that can go wrong, and I'm certainly not an oracle or a great source of truth when it comes to determining someone's aptitude. The thing that was really, really compelling is that everybody disagreed with everybody else when it came to both strong candidates and ones that were less strong. So the system was just very, very noisy. Nobody could come to a consensus about what a good candidate looked like independently of whether I could place them or not.
Because you took these 300 people and you placed them in front of a whole bunch of different interviewing type of people that couldn't assess resumes and there's no conclusions that matched. Like you might have one person saying, these three candidates are the best, but somebody else would say these three are the best. And so therefore you knew that it was not useful in some ways.
It's just a crapshoot. Our sample size here was a little less. I think I used around 50 resumes for this study.
It's a lot to ask somebody to look at 300 resumes.
Well, what we did was we picked a random subset of six. After six, people's eyes start to melt.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But each subject got a random subset of six, and we had hundreds of subjects. So we thought, okay, this is probably enough. Since then, since I published the study, we've had thousands more data points. So one of my projects is to go through and make sure that these results hold up after we have a lot more data. But preliminarily, I expect that they will. After having done these two studies, I really lost a lot of faith in the way that recruiting is done in the status quo, at least at the top of the funnel.
Sure.
And I decided to fix it instead of writing angry things on the internet about it, which is what I'd been doing up to that point. So interviewing.io, which is my startup, tries to solve this problem. We think that resumes are a very poor indicator of aptitude and should not be the first thing that determines whether somebody can get an interview at a company.
Mm-hmm.
So our platform is almost like a chat roulette for technical interviews. So on one side, you have an interviewer who's coming from a company.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, you have an engineer who's looking for work. And both of them are anonymous. And they show up to the platform and they get matched dynamically. And your first interaction is just getting dropped into a collaborative coding editor with voice.
Let me describe that for people that haven't done this kind of technical interview. Normally, when I do a phone screen interview for an engineer, what I do is I give them a URL. First, we've seen each other's I've seen the resume and they know what company I'm at. And then we drop into a web form, a website, which actually allows both of us to code at the same time and see each other's code. And there's normally stuff like syntax highlighting and such. And so then I would maybe paste in a bit of code. This is a pretty standard thing for me to do in hiring at Netflix, is I'll drop in some sample code in the language we're talking about, maybe JavaScript or Objective-C or something, and just say, hey, where's the bug? Tell me about this code. And they'll just talk about it as they're reading through it, looking at it, and then they'll flag a problem, and then maybe I might say, okay, go ahead and fix that, and I'll watch what they decide to do, and I'll say, can you make this code work a little better? How would it perform? What are some of the problems with it? So we're really dissecting something that makes exactly about what we're talking about when we do our jobs. So that's the platform that you drop people into. But in your situation, it's the same thing basically, but neither person knows where the other person is, where they're coming from, or potentially, if you don't use the voice, gender or anything about them.
That's right. Voice is optional on our platform.
It'd be hard to do it without voice.
It's a little harder. The reason we made it optional is because we thought women, for instance, might want to mask their voice. And mm-hmm. in the absence of doing Bane-like Batman voice modulation, you can tell that somebody is a woman. What we found, unfortunately, is that a lot of the time when people actually choose not to use voice, it's because they're trying to do an interview from their desk at their current job feel like renting out a conference room, because then it might be obvious they're interviewing. So we're a little less excited about that than we were originally, but it's a work in progress.
Additionally, if you're doing that, it means you're not really focused.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're kind of, yeah, it makes sense.
Exactly. But
at the same time, if I was looking for work as an engineer and I don't know the company that's hiring me and I jump into this chat room, making the commitment to the time to actually do an interview, and the other side could just be somebody that doesn't even have any funding. You know, they're just doing it for fun. Like, how do I know that I'm not wasting my time with the person on the other side on both directions, right?
That's a great question. So the big value prop for interviewees on our platform is practice. Mm. So we tell them it's practice. Until it's not, right? If you do well, and if you like the offering that the person on the other side is proposing, great. Then all of a sudden, it's a real interview. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, then you just got some very, very realistic interview practice. Now, we are vetting our interviewers to make sure that they're coming from companies with a high engineering bar. And in a lot of cases...
Wait, interviewers or interviewees?
Interviewers. Well, we're vetting both right both now sides. While we're in private beta very, very aggressively. But... So
this means right now the people that are doing the interviews are actually hiring people that are hiring and have
funds
behind
their... Or sometimes it's individual interviewers from companies that are just there to become better at interviewing people.
Mm, yeah,
so they may
sense.
Not be there in an official capacity, but they're people that have done a number of technical interviews already in their career, and maybe they're trying out new questions.
So it still would be a valuable thing for the person that was doing the interviewing.
That's right.
Interviewer.
Well,
words are not very useful.
Yeah, that's something we've discovered. We're trying to come up with better ones. So far, we haven't had much luck. But the other thing we have is after each interview, there's symmetric feedback. So interviewees rate their interviewers and vice versa. So if an interviewer isn't adding much value or is coming from some organization that isn't a real entity, then they're going to get vetted out pretty quickly.
The other thing that's happening when I do an interview, I want to make sure they have an expertise in a certain domain. There are a lot of different technical type of skills. Normally, a really great engineer could probably do well in any of them, but the expertise is helpful. So there is some history, knowledge is useful, like knowing a language, for example, is a useful thing. So do you do that kind of pairing?
So for now, the product is pretty new. While we're in private beta, we've made a decision that we're going to focus exclusively on a particular type of engineer, which is a back-end generalist. Mm-hmm. So the interviews that people tend to focus more on general computer science concepts and problem-solving ability rather than knowledge of a specific domain. For instance, if you're a front-end engineer, then of course you'd need to know JavaScript very, very well, know all of its idiosyncratic ins and outs, know how to parse the DOM. Right now, we're more focused on something that's one level up, just a very general knowledge and the ability to turn ideas into code.
Okay.
But we really want to get to the point where we're tagging interviews based on domain expertise, whether it's front end or mobile or data science.
Yeah, because even on a back-end engineer, kind of mid-tier generalist, you do probably want to know if they're what kind of deployment strategies they've been using, what kind of database involvement they've been doing, if they're using REST services. Like, there's some stuff in there that you kind of want to know whether they're, you know, what have they been doing a lot of SOAP development for years, or if they're doing, you know, using Mongo for a lot. I mean, there's definitely scopes that are slightly different. But you're right that in that general ballpark, it probably works. What happens after the interview goes well?
Yeah. So if an interview goes well, we actually encourage companies to de-anonymize as quickly as possible. And while they have this great rapport with somebody because they've just solved a problem together, start selling and explaining what they're working on and what projects are coming up, and giving them some really deep insight into exactly what they would be doing if they were to join. And we think this is a lot more powerful than what happens in the status quo, because there's a lot of value asymmetry in a typical interview. As a candidate, you don't really get to talk to the people that you'd be working with or the people that can really tell you what's up until quite a bit into the process. First, you have to show a certain amount of interest. You have to do some scheduling. You have to talk to recruiters.
You have three or four conversations about what the position might be, but from an outside perspective, it's not very clear.
And
you read the
job
description.
Yeah.
You're talking to people that don't even really work at the company necessarily. If they do, not even in the same department. It's a very odd early, and that's actually a lot of wasted time. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, if you think of, if you want to get to the step where you know, oh, this person's qualified, like that's what we're trying to get to, right? So you suggest that the company that's doing the hiring, if that pre-screen interview goes really well, de-anonymize, and then say, let's talk about you coming in.
Yeah. And what we found is that when the interviewer is bought into the person that they're interviewing, they're going to do a much better job selling. Generally, I mentioned I did like 500 interviews in a year. And the way we structured our interviews was spend the first 10 minutes answering questions and getting this person excited about the company before even jumping into the code. And
wasted time.
It's a total waste of time because you have no idea if they're a fit. Maybe they're not technically strong enough, or maybe they're just, there are any number of things, but it's very hard to sell without really establishing rapport.
Absolutely.
Here, we try to establish that it's worth it to both sides. And then once they actually get into the conversation about the company, they already have a little bit of a vested interest in continuing the conversation.
I'm speaking with Elaine Lerner. She's the CEO and founder of interviewing.io, a recruiter by trade, and started their own company to solve the problems of technical recruiting, which as a technical person in Silicon Valley, I know all too well. I'm irritated by recruiters in a lot of ways. So no offense to your profession. making it anonymous early on, this sounds like it could also solve some of the biases that we have about gender and race and age in tech industry. Is that part of your motivation?
Absolutely. I find that the biases we have are, although I think they exist for all those groups, a lot of the time they're even more fundamental. It's just, and these are rules that companies make. They will say, we're not going to interview anybody that didn't go to one of these five schools or didn't work at one of these five companies. And the world is changing. More and more people are learning to code outside of the system with the emergence of things like Coursera and Udacity and just more resources and the barrier to entry getting lower and lower. If you want to code, all you really need is a computer and an internet connection. And if you're doing, depending on what language you're using, you really, really don't need much infrastructure. And there's so many great resources out there. So there are going to be more and more people flooding the market that don't come from a traditional background. And over and over in my career, I've seen these people overlooked, and it's a shame. After I left TrialPay, where I did some of the data-driven writing about hiring, I started my own technical recruiting agency, actually, and I discovered that it was very, very hard to convince companies to talk to people that didn't look very, very homogenous and didn't have a bunch of stamps on their foreheads.
Right.
And I was very frustrated because as an engineer, I can actually vet people fairly well and at least determine that they can code. Maybe I don't know everything about a company's specific stack, but I can tell whether they can solve problems. And getting these people in the door was really, really tough. And of course, once they got the chance to show what they could do, they would shine.
Yeah.
But most of them don't even get a chance to show what they can do. And
so this added to your frustration and your solution.
Yeah. Yes.
So in the beta program of interviewing.io, you're doing one kind of engineer, which makes sense, right, to focus on something. What are you finding in the test results? How many people are using it, or what kind of numbers are you finding, and where do you have to grow?
Yeah, we have around 12,000 people on our waiting list right now, and we have a few hundred active users mm-hmm. that we've let on. So let's see, the platform now has over 500 interviews. So we've started doing some data analysis.
Are you pulling in people's resumes as well, but not showing them so that you can compare resume knowledge versus actual interview experience?
Yeah. So once we have somebody's email, you know, with the internet being what it is, you can kind of figure out where they work. You can look at their LinkedIn at the very minimum. And so we have that information.
So you're still doing your data science kind of stuff in here. Very cool.
We're very, very excited to share some of the things we found with the world. I'll tell you one thing. Right now, one of the things we ask after an interview for interviewees is, how well do you think you did? Mm-hmm. And of course, we also know how well the interviewer said they did. There is no correspondence. Best people suffer from intense imposter syndrome.
Yep.
We have people rate themselves and the other person on a scale of 1 to 4. And we've seen a lot of cases where the interviewer will say 4 out of 4, like stellar job. And the person will either give themselves a 1 or a 2, thinking that they did very, very poorly.
Oh my gosh. Do you actually surface the data later to the individual that rated themselves so low?
Yes. So we have a mutually incentivized feedback, which means kind of like Airbnb.
Yeah, sure.
You write feedback for the other person, they write feedback for you. And as soon as you submit yours and they submit theirs, then you can see what they said.
Right. So you can't see what the other person said until you've said what you said.
That, exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. So people might be couching their bets, right? I mean, that's a human nature to kind of downplay yourself.
They also, the interviewer can't see what they think, how they think they did. That's private.
That's private. So it's really, okay, great. So it's really, okay, cool. Well, Elaine Lerner is the CEO and founder of interviewing.io, which is currently in kind of a public beta. You can sign up for it, private beta.
No,
that's what I meant. You can sign up to potentially participate if you're a hiring manager that's hiring currently in this middle tier general knowledge stack. And if you are, you probably know who you are. Or if you're an interviewee that want to do that. And are you allowing like college students and stuff in this, or are you really trying to make sure that they have some experience already?
For now, we're focusing a little bit more on more experienced people, but mm-hmm. we certainly have some students on the platform, especially ones that have had a bit of industry experience. And these days, college students tend to have quite a bit.
Absolutely. Well, Elaine Lerner, thank you so much for joining me on GeekSpeak.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence's, used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know the geek said hi. This is independent public radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. To find out more about this episode of GeekSpeak or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at geekspeak.org. You can also send us email, we're geeks at geekspeak.org, and we're on Twitter and Facebook as KOSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. So thank you, Elaine Lerner, for joining me, and for Ben Jaffe and joining me in the first half. Hey, Ben, come back and say goodbye.
Bye.
See you all next week.